All right, Joshua 22. We'll finish up there this morning and get into Joshua chapter 23. We looked at Joshua 22 last time together, and thank you for not making me look at that. So I think I'm connected. If I'm not, let me know and I'll redo it. Am I good? There we go. All right. Every once in a while, it doesn't cooperate with me. But we looked at Joshua chapter 22 last time, and it's kind of interesting. In the book of Joshua, there's times when we get almost it's a sort of real-time play-by-play with certain events, and then there's big chunks of time that are summarized in one chapter that's months or years. Well, Joshua 22 is one of those almost real-time events. And we looked at it last time of the promise fulfilled, the apprehension on the part of the 2.5 tribes. The 2.5 tribes kept their promise to Moses. They stayed with their others until all the land had been divided out, and then they were ready to go home. Their apprehension was that they would be excluded because they were on the other side of Jordan. You see in verses 11 through 20, we saw a presumption on the part of the 9.5 tribes. When they crossed the river, they made a large monument or memorial as a testimony that they were part of Israel, even though they were on the other side of the river. And then in verses 21 through 30, and I believe this is where we left off last time, they explained themselves. Verse 26, therefore we said, let us now prepare to build us an altar, not for burnt offering or sacrifice, but it may be a witness between us and you and generations after us, that we might do the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings, that your children may not say to our children in time to come, you have no part in the Lord. So their motives were simply to stay connected to the main body. So in verse 31 of the chapter, we see crisis avoided, crisis averted. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, said to the children of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, this day we perceive the Lord is among us, because you have not committed this trespass against the Lord, and now you have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and the princes returned from the children of Reuben and Gad out of the land of Gilead unto the land of Canaan to the children of Israel and brought them word again. They were all gathering for war while they sent ambassadors to kind of feel out the situation. And, you know, to me, I appreciate the zeal of, hey, we don't want to do this. But I also see a reminder. Sometimes the only exercise we get is jumping to conclusions, right? And, you know, you can make a great big mess doing that kind of thing. But they heard, they made an assumption or a presumption, and they started to act without having the rest of the details. Now, again, it was interesting. We mentioned this last week, but the incident with Peor, which was Balaam, and then the incident with Achan, and all of that, they said, look, haven't you learned your lesson by now? Disobeying God does not pay, and we're not going to put up with it. And that kind of zeal was commendable, but they needed to, you know, ask some questions first. And so basically, they called off the war and sent everybody home, is what it says in the end of the chapter here. So Moses had warned the 2.5 tribes, hey, if you stay here, you're going to be separated. And they are already realizing that as they went along. And later on, history would bear out that because they were the furthest away, they were the first to be attacked in many instances. And it was not, you know, beneficial. But they did, you know, return to that land and enjoy it for a while. All right, now that brings us to chapter 23. And this is Joshua's farewell admonition. Really, there's two parts to this. Chapter 23 is one part. Chapter 24 is part two. But today we're just going to look at the chapter 23 section, okay? But in chapter 23, verse 1, it came to pass a long time after that, a long time after that the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua waxed old and stricken in age. All right? Based on the Hebrew terms there, that period, long time, means what? Brother Lockhart. I'm just kidding. We'll let Jim Bray tell it. No. What does it mean? It means a long time. How many years? No idea. We're not told. If we needed to know a number, God would have told us. Okay? We don't know. It just says a long time after that. How long is a long time? Well, some of that depends on your age. You know, like right now, you're thinking, oh man, you know, 20-something days till Christmas to do, you know, to find gifts or mail cards or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't seem like a long time. And you tell your kids, how long is it till Christmas? 24 days. That's forever, right? So it's sometimes how much is a long time totally depends on your perspective. If you do not enjoy theme parks, then, you know, how long till the park closes? 3 hours. Oh, that's forever. The kids, only 3 hours? How many rides can I, you know? There's a lot of things in life that entirely depends on your perspective. But, you know, based on the context here, I expect that this means a good number of years. But exactly how many, I don't know. You don't know. If a commentator says they know, they're guessing. Okay? But it was a long time, and it says after that that Joshua waxed old and stricken in age. Verse 2, Joshua called for all Israel, for the elders, the heads, the judges, the officers, and said unto them, I am old and stricken in age. Ye have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations because of you, for the Lord your God, he it is that fought for you. Behold, I've divided unto you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes from Jordan, with all the nations that I've cut off, even unto the great sea westward. I see, first of all, an appreciation of their present situation. I mean, Joshua here in verse 2, it says he called for all Israel and the elders and the heads and the judges and officers. Chapter 24, verse 1 says Joshua gathered all the tribes to Shechem and called for the elders and judges and officers and all that. It seems like two different conversations. In chapter 23, we're not given a location. I mean, we could make an argument that this would be in Joshua's hometown. It would make sense to me if it happened in Shiloh, which was where the tabernacle was set up, and that was kind of their central meeting place, but we're not told about this conversation. But what we see here is an appreciation for their present situation. Look at verse 3. You've seen all that the Lord your God hath done, for the Lord your God is he that hath fought for you. Now, we had a testimony service this past week. It just took some time to appreciate, you know, things the Lord has done for us, maybe a long time ago, maybe more recently. But isn't it easy to get bogged down in the day-to-day, week-to-week, and not remember all the things the Lord has done? And once you get rolling and somebody kind of jogs your thoughts or you kind of get rolling down a track, if you start writing a list, you'll find out that, you know, at times it's quite long. Well, the Lord's done this and provided this and answered this and, you know, the many ways that the Lord has taken care of us. But you see here in verse 3 specifically, God has done unto all these nations exactly what he said he would do. Not only that, he says God has fought for you. Do you remember the wonderfully complimentary statement from Deuteronomy where Moses reminds Israel, God didn't choose you because you were the largest or the best. You're the smallest, most obscure, and insignificant among all the nations. God picked you so that everybody else would see his power, is basically what God told them. And so when it says God fought for them, it was an appreciation, first of all, of what God's done, but also kind of a reminder that nothing that they had done could they take credit for. It was God's glory that anything positive that had been accomplished. Verse 4, I've divided unto you by lot the nations that remain. What is that? Can we say it this way? Promise fulfilled, promise kept. God did exactly what he said he was going to do in providing the inheritance and allowing Joshua to see it. As we move into, you know, the Christmas season, we just need to remember, hey, life is busy, sometimes life is hard, but remember what the Lord has done for us, how he's blessed us and all of those things. You see an appreciation of their present situation. You see an assurance for the future. That's 23:5. It should also be, 15 and 16 there at the end of the chapter. It's kind of a interrupted thought or a continuation of the thought there. But in verse 5, the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them from out of your sight, and ye shall possess their land as the Lord your God hath promised unto you. Now, I thought verse 4 said he's divided it all up the land. Didn't they all have it? Yes. Does that mean there were no future situations? No. I mean, if you think about it just in terms of a new property, if you ever get a new property, you clear the lot, whether you're clearing stumps and trees and all that to build something, or whether you're trying to clear land for a garden patch. Okay, let's just say you do get it. You get it cleared and you move in there and you plant your seed. Does that mean you're done with it? No, you got weeds, fertilizer, things to do. But, very often you move in and you get things situated so you can occupy it. But that doesn't mean that, there's no further maintenance. But what happened, there's not a contradiction between verses 4 and 5. I've divided in you by lot the nations that remain. In verse 5, God will expel them from before you. There were enough of them conquered that they could move in there and occupy it and be the new leaders there, be the new force. But they weren't all driven out. I mean, if you go back and make a total of all the ites that are listed, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Moabites, Edomites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there's a lot of different people groups that are there, a lot of people groups that had been there for a long time. And so some of them likely decided to survive by just kind of keeping their head low and not putting up much of a resistance. But here what he's saying is you have the land and you have the area, and the enemies that are left, the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them from out of your sight. What is our assurance that God will keep his promises in the future? I mean, what is one of the ways we can be assured of that? I mean, verse 3 and 4, God's already kept his promises, right? One of the ways that we can be assured that God will keep his promises in the future is just remembering the ways he has kept his promises already, right? The fact that God has kept his promises is an assurance that we can rely on things we've not yet seen fulfilled. I mean, obviously, that was an open-ended question. God's promises are fulfilled because of his character, because of who he is. He'll do what he said he would do. We see it in his word. But let's just be honest, we're frail, right? And there's times we want reassurance. I mean, how can I reassure myself? How can I find comfort or assurance that God's word is going to come to pass and God's promises are reliable? Well, I could look back and see what he's already done and draw confidence from that of what he'll do in the future. Verse 5, God shall expel them and drive them out, and ye shall possess their land as God promised. You have in the works of God in the past, we have a pattern for what we can ask him to do in the future. Should bring us confidence and assurance. And, that was a repeated thing when God defeated Sihon and Og when Moses was still alive. That was something that they were told to look back on and say, look, God defeated those enemies and God will defeat future enemies. And that's a consistent pattern in this period of Israel's history, but it really applies to us. God took care of me here. God can take care of me in this situation as well. And then the next section in chapter 23, verses 6 through 13, we see an admonition. Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left. Now that should sound familiar. I mean, if it doesn't, then, I will jog your memory real quick. But God told Joshua very early on in this process, in chapter 1, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you go. And then what did God say to him in Joshua 1, verse 6? Be strong and of a good courage, for unto this people shalt thou divide for an inheritance. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law, which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth. Verse 9, have not I commanded thee, be strong and of a good courage. The word here in verse 6, be very courageous. Same idea as you have in Joshua chapter 1. The word here means to strengthen yourself, to be strong or to strengthen oneself. The idea is that I'm going to firmly hold on to the promises of God. Be strong is I am going to harden myself, so to speak, in a positive way? You know, if I'm going to hang on to something, do I need a, you know, flimsy grip? Or I need a firm grip? All right? I mean, well, the idea of be strong is that I'm going to, you know, hold tightly to. You know, you want to get a little boy to put a big smile on his face, say, show me your muscle. You know, what do you do? All right? But that same idea of firmness or hardening in the sense of, you know, I'm going to cling tightly to the promises of God. Here, the same lesson that Joshua had been admonished to learn, the same lesson that he had to learn earlier, he's telling Israel the same thing. Be ye therefore very courageous, what? To keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law. That sounds a lot like Joshua 1:8, doesn't it? This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, then thou shalt have good success. But that observe to do is important. And so here, the same lessons that Joshua had to learn, he's now, you know, passing on to them. Do you find yourself at your stage of life, you know, being a parent, or in some cases, grandparent? Do you find yourself, you know, saying, okay, yeah, I had to go through this, or this is what I learned in this situation, or, you know, you kind of look back and say, yep, I had to learn this lesson, and now here's where you're at in life. The Lord does that. But, you know, Joshua is only able to teach lessons because he had grown, and he had made spiritual progress. But now the same lessons the Lord has taught him, he's passing down to future generations. Be courageous and keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. Verse 7, that ye come not among these nations that remain among you. Now, doesn't that seem strange? How are they going to live there but come not among them? Well, I mean, there's more context to it. Come not among these nations, neither make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause to swear by them, neither serve them, nor bow yourselves unto them, but cleave unto the Lord your God, as you have done unto this day. So you have the admonition here, you know, be courageous, keep the law of God. And then there's some things to avoid. Come not among these nations is in the context of fellowship. He said, if you hang out with them, you will start talking about their gods, and then you're tempted to serve them or bow yourselves to them. How many times from the Exodus to the end of Joshua's life did God warn Israel about idolatry? Dozens? Hundreds? You know, over and over and over again. You know, don't serve their gods. You know, the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. I mean, that's right where he started off. But it's almost like God knew what their weak point was going to be, right? What the big temptation was going to be. But he said, don't fool with it. Don't make mention of the name of their gods. In other words, if you don't start talking about it, if you don't start showing curiosity and interest, it doesn't drag you further along the path there. Verse 8, cleave to the Lord your God as you've done this day. Pretty strong word, isn't it? Cleave to. I mean, the word cleave is to hold on to tightly, to grasp firmly. You know, to, if we could use a modern day expression a little bit, to hang on for dear life. There's things that we hang on to for dear life sometimes, right? I mean, sometimes you're trying to look it up on YouTube how to fix something while your hands are greasy and you try to hang on to the phone for dear life so you don't smash it, right? Or you're trying to hang on to a tool or instrument, utensil in the kitchen. This is far more serious, though, to cleave to the Lord your God. But you see the positive statement in the end of verse 8? You know, there's so many times it's like, don't worship these gods, don't do this, and all the warnings. But you see a positive statement in the end of verse 8. As ye have done unto this day. I mean, they did well. They were following God. They had seen God's works. They had believed Moses. They had believed Joshua. They had seen God keep promises. In fact, we saw that in chapter 22, didn't we? The first time they thought there was a hint of idolatry, they were all over it. And so at this point, there is a desire to obey God. There is an intensity. Cleave unto the Lord as ye have done. Verse 9, for the Lord hath driven out from before you great nations and strong. But as for you, no man hath been able to stand before you unto this day. One man of you shall chase a thousand. For the Lord your God, he it is that fighteth for you as he hath promised you. Take good heed therefore unto yourselves that ye love the Lord your God. So in verse 8, he says, cleave to the Lord your God. Verse 11, he says, love the Lord your God. Two different ways of expressing the same idea of hold tightly to the Lord. But how is it that one man of you will chase a thousand? Now, is there a recorded instance in the Scripture where one man defeated a thousand? There's a couple. In Judges, you know, one guy killed 600, or didn't Samson kill 1,000 men with a jawbone? I mean, you have a few instances like that, but the idea here, one man chase 1,000, the idea is, yeah, you're still outnumbered. You're still small. You can't brag on your own strength. But if 1,000 men run away from one, does that mean that one man is a superhero? No, that means God's intervening on their behalf, and he's still reminding them of that. Hey, all the victories that you've gotten, it's because God fights for you. It's God that is working on your behalf. Take good heed, therefore, to yourselves that ye love the Lord your God. Else, if verse 12, if ye in any wise do go back and cleave to the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them and go in unto them and they to you, know for a certainty the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations. Now, we'll get there in just a second. But you see there, take good heed, therefore, unto yourselves that ye love the Lord your God. Verse 12, if in any wise you go back. Isn't love presented many times in our society as something that just happens? As a feeling, you know, as you know, a circumstance, something that you fall into. I mean, this right here kind of makes it sound like loving God is a choice. And it also makes it sound like that loving God is something to be maintained, doesn't it? Because he says, cleave to the Lord, take good heed that you love the Lord, else if you in any wise go back and cleave to the remnant. So whether I cleave to the Lord or whether I cleave to the nations, it's a choice. But is he speaking to backslidden people at this point? I mean, in verse 8, he just said, cleave to the Lord as ye have done to this day. I mean, he's speaking to people that love the Lord, that want to do right, that have followed God. And even to them, there's a reminder, hey, you've got to continue to cleave to the Lord. You've got to continue to choose to love the Lord. You know what that means? If you're still here, you're still breathing, you have to intentionally serve God. You know, when can I just relax and say, okay, it'll be on autopilot? Not as long as I'm in this body. I mean, if I relax and go to autopilot in this body, my sin nature will take over and I will turn and go away from the Lord, and you will too. He's reminding them to renew that commitment, if I could say it that way, to maintain a commitment. I mean, their direction was admirable and it was appropriate, but it also needed fuel. I mean, some of you this time of year, I'm sure, like to sit by a fireplace or a campfire, right? Maybe, I don't know, maybe the sitting outside by the campfire has lost its allure. I'd rather sit by the fireplace inside the house, you know? I don't know, some of that is kind of cyclical. If Bill Spence were here, he would vote for the outdoor stuff. Okay. But whether you like the campfire outside or the fireplace inside, doesn't matter how good you are at lighting a fire or how well you build it, it will not burn forever without adding fuel. I know, that's the kind of insight for which you come to Sunday school, right? Learn new things. But, you know, our relationship with the Lord is the same way. It's not like, okay, I've built a big enough fire that it'll never go out. It needs fuel. It needs food. It needs the oxygen and the fuel. And we must maintain that love for the Lord and that relationship with the Lord. Even though they were right with God, as best we can tell at this point, he said, hey, you got to take heed to yourselves. Be careful. Pay attention. Don't take things for granted. Love God. Don't go back and cleave to the remnant of these nations. As long as I'm alive, cleaving to God is a choice. That's why it's an admonition. It's a command, if you will. It is a reminder. It's not an assumption of fact. Verse 12, else if ye in any wise go back and cleave to the remnants of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them, go in unto them, and they unto you. Verse 13, know for a certainty, the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your side, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off the good land which the Lord your God hath given you. So you have an admonition. You have God's goodness, His promises, but you also have a warning. If you turn away from God and cleave unto idols, God will no longer help you. No longer will one man chase a thousand. No longer would a thousand on a thousand go in your favor either. God will no longer help you, and you're in trouble. Now, I don't know about you, but you know, some of these things I may not identify with as well. They shall be snares and traps. I don't know. Any of you still building snares and traps? I mean, if you need a trap now, you probably buy a mouse trap, right? Or a raccoon, possum, cat trap, whatever. Probably not building them. Those things maybe I don't identify with as much in a real sense, but I'm telling you, the part where it says thorns, that part I can identify with. You know, whether it's on the flower bushes or, you know, walking through the woods. I don't know what it is, but around our house, there seems to be no productive part of it. You know, blackberry vines, you know, there's thorns everywhere, but at least there's some fruit on it, right? Well, around our house, and maybe it's that way around where you are, but there's these green vines that grow that are covered with thorns, and they seem to produce nothing. It's just vines and thorns, and they're everywhere. And right, we were doing storm cleanup, you know, back in September after Helene came through. And there was a tree that had come down. It was kind of leaning over the neighbor's shed. And we threw a rope or a strap around it. And we're trying to, and then a rope, we were trying to pull it a certain way to keep it from falling on anything and damaging it. And so, I mean, there was three or four of us that were working on this. But one of the fellas that was pulling on the rope got really enthusiastic about it. And when it did come loose and it came this way, he went backwards and right into that a whole bed of just these green vines with thorns. I mean, doesn't matter if you got long sleeves or not, you come up and you're all scratched up, and you know, that's not fun. I mean, I doubt any of you have thought, how do I make my pillow more comfortable? Let me go put some thorns in it. How do I make the couch or the recliner more comfortable? But what God is saying here is, if you want that kind of pain, irritation, difficulty, constant annoyance, and opposition, all you have to do is turn away from God. But they're going to be traps and snares and thorns. Now, thorns in your eyes? I mean, it's one thing to get it in your arm, get it in your leg, you know, get it in your hand. I don't even want to imagine a thorn in my eye. But what God is saying is, His blessings in large part accompany obedience. Now, that's not 100% across the board, and what I mean by that is this. If you're a child of God, you cannot lose your salvation. You can be chastened, but in very large part, God's blessings accompany obedience. In the same way, chastening accompanies disobedience, and that's what the principle that's being drawn here is. If you obey God, He'll continue to fight for you. If you decide to turn away from God, He'll turn away from you, and it's going to be painful, uncomfortable, difficult. Verse 14, you have an acceptance of current realities. You see it in verses 1 and 2, but we see it again in verse 14. Behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. What's He saying? I know my time's getting short. That's what He's saying. He said it again in verse 2, I'm old and stricken in age. Here in verse 14, He says, I know I'm going the way of all the earth. You have acceptance of His situation. God has blessed him. God has given him a long life. God has fulfilled His promises and allowed him to live in the land and enjoy some of that. But He said, hey, the reality is, if you live long enough, you'll die. I know that's brilliant and deep, isn't it? You live long enough, you'll die. But that's where he said, look, I know my time is drawing to an end. My time is short. But then he goes on to say in verse 14, you know in your hearts and in your souls that not one thing hath failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spake concerning you. All are come to pass unto you. Not one thing hath failed. So while you have an acceptance of current reality, you also have an acknowledgement of God's faithfulness. Not one good thing hath failed of all which God has said concerning you. That's a testimony to God's faithfulness, is it not? If we haven't seen something come to pass, it's not because of God's character. It's because of, you know, our decisions. But this is multiple times now in this brief conversation that he said, look, God promised you he'd drive out the people. He did. God promised you he'd give you the land. I've divided it by lot to you. God has fought for you. Here he says it again. Not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spake concerning you. Verse 15, therefore it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you, which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all evil things, until he have destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you. When you have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods and bowed yourselves to them, then shall the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and ye shall perish quickly from off the good land which he had given unto you. You see, God's faithfulness is a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. Usually when we talk about God's faithfulness, we talk about it in the context of, you know, if we're God is faithful to keep his promises and he blesses those that are obedient and that kind of thing. But you know, God is faithful to keep his promises of judgment when folks disobey as well. So God's bringing judgment and allowing them to fall prey to their enemies and such is just as much God's faithfulness as, if we could say it this way, the positive or the blessing or the desired outcome. Why? Because God keeps his word. When God says, if you obey, I'll bless you, he keeps that promise. But when God says, you disobey, I'll spank you, he keeps that promise too. So both aspects of this are an acknowledgement of God's faithfulness, his consistency, his truth, his embodiment of truth. He said, it's your choice. You ever had that conversation with your kids or your grandkids? Hey, you can do this and it'll turn out this way, or you can do this and it'll turn out the other way. It's your choice. If you're going to be stupid, you better be tough, right? But here, in essence, Joshua one more time is saying, look, God is not one to lie. He's not one to change his mind. If you obey God, you'll continue to see God's blessings. If you fall away, you're going to see God's chastening. You're going to see the opposite of all of this. Has God been consistent in that in his dealings with man? I mean, we go all the way back to the garden. He gave them one condition, and you know, God kept it. When God, you can go all the way down through the line, whether it's Noah who found grace or the wickedness of the earth there, but you can go all the way down through the line, and God's been consistent. You know, what he says he will do, he does. It's a comfort to those that are trying to serve the Lord. It's a caution or a warning to those who are disobedient. But if Joshua, in verse 8, says, at this point, they are cleaving to the Lord, and they still needed this reminder, and I figure you and I probably need it too. It's not just like a message to the ones that are being hard-headed and rebellious and, you know, outwardly disobedient. This is a reminder to those that are trying to do right, trying to cleave to the Lord, trying to be faithful, to, hey, keep putting fuel on the fire. Keep trusting God's word. Don't be enamored with the new toys. Any of you get any, you know, Black Friday advertisements? Sick and tired of them? Hey, new this. You know, sometimes we can get discouraged in our circumstance, and so, well, maybe I'm going to try something different because it seems like I'm trying to serve the Lord. It's not working out like I thought. I mean, that's just advertising. And we need the admonition. Don't be distracted by that. God's faithful. Stay the course. As we know, sometimes you see the outcome. Sometimes we trust God for the outcome by faith when we don't see how it's all going to work out and come together. But here, they were cleaving to the Lord. They were doing well. And yet Joshua's admonition was, don't let the fire go out. Continue to put fuel on the fire. Guard your relationship with God. follow him tenaciously, be strong and of a good courage, you know, hold tenaciously to that obedience to God. If they needed that reminder, then it does us good too, doesn't it? God is faithful, and I'd rather be on the blessing side of that faithfulness than on the spanking side of that, wouldn't you? Let's continue to love the Lord. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for your admonitions. Lord, thank you for good examples of folks that have served you and seen your blessing and provision. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to see that and be able to be examples of that to our children and grandchildren as well. And Lord, we pray your blessings on the service today and the outreach with the parade and all the related things. Well, thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, and you're dismissed.